debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully.
Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore them. America, north and south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the people. We are a nonprofit whose mission is to educate the American people and people around the world about the costs of allowing corporate control of our government. I'm your host, Dr. Rick Stagenborg, and my guest today is Allison Weir, who some of you may remember from a couple of other appearances. She is a freelance journalist who in 2000 went to Israel-Palestine to find out about the second Intifada, Palestinian uprising, and discovered to her horror that everything she'd been told by the corporate media was false. And so she's made it her life mission ever since to find out the truth about what's going on in Israel and Palestine, and she founded an organization called If Americans Knew at ifamericansknew.com, where she's writing about what she has found out about the realities on the ground in Israel-Palestine. She also is the president of the Council for the American Interests, which is an organization dedicated to educating the American public about the influence of the Zionist lobby on American foreign policy and the ways in which that is not consistent with what most of us would think of as American interests. This is directly related to the subject of today's talk about her book, Against Our Better Judgment, about the history of how Zionism came to be such a power in the United States and have that kind of influence on our foreign policy. And hi, Allison. Thanks for being back on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
I've been trying to get you on the show for a while. You've been very busy with everything that's been going on, some of which is very relevant to what we're going to be talking about today, and that is the influence of the Zionist lobby in United States foreign policy. I mentioned in the introduction that you are the head of the Council for American Interests. You are the president, right, of the Council for American
Interests? That's right. The council, it's actually the Council for the National Interest.
Oh, the National Interest. I apologize. With all this furor over Netanyahu coming and speaking before Congress under the conditions that had happened, It really seems to be waking people up to the fact that there is a very profound influence on our national foreign policy that is really for the interests of another country and not our own, and this is disturbing people. That's the way I see it. What do you think? Do you think this is a positive development?
You mean the conflict in Congress over Netanyahu's speech in general? Yes.
Data.
Well, it certainly it is interesting because, you know, for once we see a split between the two parties. Usually they're both just trying to outdo the other one in professing loyalty to a foreign country, Israel. So seeing a case where the Democratic Party is supporting our president and the Republicans are not is a new situation, and it certainly is making certainly the liberal half of the country think twice about this so-called ally whose prime minister is treating, you know, our president and our processes with such disdain. So I think that is a little more obvious than it's probably been in the past, even though other presidents from both parties have to small degrees now and then tried to oppose the Israel lobby and tried to oppose Israeli actions that are, you know, both wrong and damaging to Americans. But usually that was very quickly out of the public eye and people forget about it. But this stayed in the public eye for quite a long time. So that's been very interesting.
Well, I sure hope it continues to stay in the public eye. And I think it's very important that people realize that this is not about what the corporate media generally tends to paint it out to be, which is, did Boehner follow protocol or, should they even invite a foreign leader to speak to Congress, or should they do it before that leader faces an election? Those are all side issues. The big issue here is that he came specifically to get us involved in a war in Iran, and that is clearly to any thinking person. It's not just a liberal issue; it's a conservative issue too. To any thinking person, getting involved in a war with Iran on false pretexts is not in the national interest. That sort of highlights why this book you wrote is so important, Against Our Better Judgment. Because a lot of people think when you start talking about the influence of the Zionist lobby that you're talking about a Jewish plot, as if all Zionists were Jews, or you're talking about conspiracy theory. But you detail in this book exactly how the Zionist lobby came to be so powerful in the United States. I think that's important. But I wanted to ask you, first off, why did you write the book? Because I can think of lots of reasons why that's important. But what motivated you to write this book?
Well, it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll try to make it a short one. I'm not Jewish or Arab or Muslim or Palestinian. And up until 15 years ago, I really knew very little about this issue. I didn't really think it had anything to do with me, and we're all very busy, so I had never focused ever before on Israel-Palestine. I was certainly sympathetic to Israel. I had seen Paul Newman in Exodus, and, you know, we're all very just excruciatingly aware of the Nazis and what was done in during World War II. So apart from that, I, like most people, really did not have any particular views on the subject, you know, other than, as I say, being certainly sympathetic to Israel. But then in fall of 2000, when the second Palestinian uprising, as it's called, began, it was in the news. It was a point in my life where I sort of had a little more time than usual, although I was the editor of a small local newspaper. But I just got curious about Israel-Palestine, since, you know, that uprising was in the news, and I wondered what it was about. I decided I would just follow that news coverage to see what was going on and to become knowledgeable about it. When I did that, by paying attention to it as a journalist, I quickly noticed the coverage was very one-sided. We would hear from and about Israelis far more often than we heard from and about Palestinians. I looked into it more and more. Began to use the internet to look into international coverage to see what I could learn, was astounded at what was actually going on there compared to the very filtered type of reporting we were getting in the U.S. from across the political spectrum, you know, the so-called liberal media and the conservative media, were largely giving us filtered reporting. It was very Israeli-centric reporting. So after a while, I decided to travel over to the West Bank and Gaza as a freelance reporter by myself to see what was going on. I saw what was going on. I was, you know, truly shocked at the violence with which Israel was treating a largely unarmed population, the number of children that had been shot. Quite a few of them had been shot in the head. Entire neighborhoods were, in some locations, bullet-riddled, and in some cases, buildings were in ruins. And this was early 2001. This was before any rockets had been fired, before Hamas was elected. That came several years later. And that there was already this massive violence by the extremely powerful Israeli military forces against the Palestinians in the occupied territories. So when I came back, I started an organization called If Americans Knew, a journalistic approach. It's very nonpartisan, just to give Americans the facts on this issue, and especially to tell us all of our connection to this issue. There are, you know, many important international issues. It's hard to know about all of them, but this is one we're very closely connected to, and it's essential that we know about it. From that time since, I began reading books and trying to learn about what had caused us to have this, quote, this really uniquely special relationship with Israel, why and how that had come about. So I've read book after book. I look for books that I feel are reliable, that have factual information. I look at the footnotes. I then often get the books that are mentioned in the footnotes, read those books, look at those footnotes to see where they got that information, order still more books. And I've been doing that now for, about 14 years. And a few years ago, I realized that I knew aspects about the history of the U.S.-Israel relationship and what drove it that almost nobody else seemed to know. Even people that knew the history of the region extremely well and had known it far longer than I have been even paying attention to it. But the U.S. connection, I suddenly realized I had learned all this information from books that are largely now out of print. You know, and therefore they're not online. And if information is not online in today's world, if it's not on the internet, it's pretty much invisible to most people. So at that point, I decided that I needed to write, at first I thought just an in-depth article, and then quickly realized that really it would have to be a book. And that's how the book began.
So what you're saying is the importance of this is that people need to understand how the Zionist lobby got so powerful. But I guess what I'm after here is exactly why is that knowledge so important?
Well, a number of reasons. One reason is we give Israel far more of our tax money than any other country on earth, $3 billion per year. It's over $8 million per day. Really, it's closer now to $10 million per day. To a tiny population, this is one of the smallest countries on earth. In addition, it is partisans who are working on behalf of Israel, specifically in many cases, this group of people that are called neoconservatives. They're not really conservative in most of their policies at all, who are working on behalf of Israel have pushed us into the war in Iraq, which, as I think most of us know by now, was a huge mistake. Caused massive loss of life in Iraq, many American servicemen as well. Many others are now permanently injured and disabled because of a war that really was unnecessary and had, you know, there was really no reason for us to enter that war. But partisans for Israel pushed us into it, both in the government, they were in George Bush's administration, and also in the media, carried that message through. And at first, we were told that this was because of weapons of mass destruction that we now know did not exist, and that there was evidence already did not exist. But, you know, the media pushed that line, and these so-called, you know, anonymous government sources that would be mentioned in news reports would be talking about these so-called weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, then the excuse morphed into, well, we're bringing democracy to Iraq by killing the people. That's not really how you do that. That's also, you know, been shown to be a fallacy. So this horrible war was pushed on behalf of Israel. Now the same groups are once again behind the anti-Iran push that we see, in which we continually are given reports that either say or suggest that Iran is developing nuclear weapons, even though our intelligence agencies consistently tell us that that's not the case. There's no such evidence. All of the evidence that we've been able to find points to the likelihood that Iran is not developing nuclear weapons. Although it has the full right to do that, it's not doing it. So again, we see Israel partisans very much pushing Americans into potentially another disastrous war that would be disastrous on every level. But once again, this is being pushed because Iran is seen as an adversary to Israel, just as Iraq was, and therefore it must be disabled, despite the fact that that would entail huge loss of life. You know, this is what's pushing this current U.S. policy. Economic sanctions against a country that did nothing against us, has no record of any violence against us, or, you know, and yet we have we've now enacted a major blockade against another country that really amounts to a declaration of war, as I understand it, according to international law. Fortunately, Iran's not taking it that way, but, you know, that's the level of what we have already done, once again pushed by Israel partisans, both in the government and in the media and elsewhere.
Well, there's no doubt that these wars of aggression, including these economic wars against Iraq and Iran and Syria, which have all been economically blockaded, among other countries, have been pushed by the Zionist lobby. Let me just clarify. I want to make sure I understand this. Are you saying that if it weren't for the Zionist lobby, that the U.S. wouldn't be involved in these wars? Because a lot of people say, well, they also benefit the international oil companies, the international banking industries, including American banks, and the weapons manufacturers.
Yeah, those myths are out there. You know, these are theories that some people prefer because, for one thing, then you're not called anti-Semitic. So, you know, you'd rather go with something that doesn't get you called names, so you can, you know, blame the oil industry or the weapons industry or, you know, or corporations or anything that are, you know, certainly are culpable of many negative policies. But that's not what's driving this. There are excellent books that have analyzed this in great detail. One of them is called The Transparent Cabal by Dr. Steven Snigowski. He goes through a meticulous recital of what happened to push us into the Iraq War. A more recent book that was published by Edinburgh University, I think the title is The Road to Iraq. I think it is. I can maybe check this. But another excellent book that goes through, again, in detail, fully footnoted and cited. So, again, you know, it's important to check the evidence that an author is putting forward. But it goes through, not only does it show who and why the war against Iraq was pushed, it looks at these other theories. You know, was it the oil industry? Was it the weapons industry? Was it the military-industrial complex? And goes through in detail analyzing the evidence for and against that and finding that, no, those were not the primary factors. They were, in many cases, not even secondary factors.
Interesting. Well, I'll have to look at those books to form my own independent opinion on that, but that's certainly an eye-opener to hear that research has even been done. So,
yeah, it's interesting that, you know, these aren't... If this were a book that purported to show that those were the reasons, if these were books that pushed an analysis saying that it was not because of Israel partisans, that it was because of these other factors, we would all know about them. They would be, you know, the authors would have been interviewed on Amy Goodman. They would have been on NPR, the New York Times, probably not Fox News on that particular one, but, you know, they would be well-known books. But, you know, again, this shows the power of the media in particular to make some books known to all of us, or we're all talking about them and aware they exist, and make us completely unaware of very important books that nobody's talking about and in many cases almost no one has even heard of.
Sure, and that's what you cover in your book a number of times, including towards the end in a special section, and that is the Zionist influence on the media. And again, this comes right back to this whole idea that people try to say, if you really try to talk about the power of the Zionist lobby in American politics, that you must be an anti-Semite or you're some kind of wild-eyed conspiracy theorist talking about the Jewish plot to take over the world or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, there are certain undeniable facts that point to a very strong Zionist influence over the media going way back before World War I, correct?
That's correct. That's right. And again, it's what Zionist, and I don't usually use the term Zionist just because most of us don't really, you know, I don't know if I even heard that term before. You know, 15 years ago, if somebody asked me what I thought of Zionist or Zionism, I'm guessing I probably would have said, well, what exactly is that? I think I've heard that term. What is it? And I think, you know, again, that's really astounding, given it's a very important ideology and movement, and yet it's impacted the U.S. enormously, and yet most of us know very little about it at all. In fact, you know, many of us don't even know it was a movement in the United States. You know, what Israel partisans tend to do is they put up a straw man argument that most of us that are trying to write factually and learn what's gone on are not saying, you know, my book has nothing to do with some, you know, plot by Jews to take over the world or something bizarre like that. It goes through modern history from the late 1800s on through, my book actually ends at 1950. I'll be writing a second book that will go from 1950 until today. You know, this is not ancient history. This is not archaeology. There are many documents that are available that show what happened, what went on, who did what. Often the information that I have is from the journals and documents from Zionist leaders, what their plans were, what they did. Many of the books that I've used in my own book are by very, very highly regarded authors, many of them very pro-Israel, who think what went on was a good thing because it caused the creation of Israel. Many of us who are Americans and know what Israel is doing today don't find their actions that are described in these books so laudable at all. In fact, in a number of cases, I find them fairly outrageous. But this is factual information about our own country that we should know, and most of us don't know. So people that don't want that information known would rather just call me names or not even mention my book, rather than really grapple with the troubling facts that have occurred in the history of our own country and elsewhere. So, you know, rather than talking about facts and perhaps debating these facts and analysis as would normally be done with history, they'd rather just call names. You know, as an Israeli politician, a former member of the Israeli Knesset, said very openly, and, you know, as saying that it was not a good thing. She was not in favor of it, but she said anti-Semitism, that's a trick. We always use it. And, you know, she's certainly correct. As soon as anyone says something that is conveying information about Israel that is negative, then inevitably, almost, you know, almost every time you're called anti-Semitic for having done that. Even those of us, and as most people, who have a life history of opposing bigotry of all kinds, you know, still this epithet is used against anyone as a way to try to discredit that person, to prevent their information from being known. It's done to silence others who don't want to be called names and therefore will not speak about this issue. It's a very powerful trick. I think it's wearing out a little bit, but, you know, that's what's done.
Well, you know, what's really interesting to me is that a lot of the people who don't ask questions about what Zionism really is and accept this idea that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. These are the same people who get very angry if somebody says, well, if you criticize our president, then you must be a racist. On the other hand, it may be a way to get through to these people.
Yeah, well, there are often double standards, and I don't like that. I think we should try to be consistent. If we have a principle we believed in, it should be applied universally. And I think often it's not. You know, this is probably not the only case, but certainly Absolutely. It's the case here.
Well, I think there's some truth when people say that defenders of the president will accuse his detractors of racism when they have a point. I think there's a lot of truth to that. It certainly is the case in both cases. And in both cases, it's also basically a way to avoid the real argument. And that's what we're talking about here when we talk about how the media manipulates public opinion on this issue. It has a lot to do with just not talking about certain points of view like yours. Or your analysis, I should say, of the facts, and playing up often very mythical accounts of what happened. That's why it's so important, in my view, for you to for people to know the facts, like in your books. Now, you mentioned earlier, I think this is an important point, about most people not even knowing what Zionism means. I use that term all the time because it does have a specific meaning, and I don't really know a synonym for it. Why don't you tell people what political Zionism is and where that, how that got started? That's the first part of your work.
Sure. And, you know, I actually just basically used the dictionary definition. You can look it up in Webster's. And Zionism was a movement to create a Jewish state. It very quickly was a movement to create a Jewish state in Palestine. Political Zionism began in the late 1800s. Palestine at that time, not surprisingly, was a very inhabited part of the world. It's, you know, an ancient part of the world, the crossroads of civilization, the Holy Land sacred to three monotheistic faiths. So not surprisingly, it was inhabited. The population when political Zionism began in the late 1800s was about 80% Muslim, about 15% Christian, and a little under 5% Jewish, all living together on that land without conflict, without violence. So the political Zionism was a movement, not a religious movement at all. In fact, at that time, most religious Jews, both in Europe, in Palestine itself, and in the United States, were opposed to Zionism. It was considered very heretical. But anyway, this movement was created in Europe, and very quickly there was a parallel and connected movement in the United States, beginning the late 1880s, to push an ideology and a political movement in which a population would be dispossessed by another group coming to take over their land. That's what political Zionism was. Today, when the term is used, it means to maintain a Jewish state in Palestine, which again, you know, to most of us sounds, well, you know, that's fine, except what that means is that it is a state that discriminates against large numbers of people. The Christians and Muslims that originally inhabited the land, many of whom are still there in Israel itself, in fact, about 20% of the population, and the people in the West Bank and Gaza that are living under Israeli occupation, that means discrimination against them and oppression, really oppression of both groups, sometimes violently. And it also means discrimination against the Palestinian refugees who have the right to return home, like all refugees around the world, regardless of race, religion, or ethnicity. Palestinian refugees have the right to return home, but Zionism, intent on preventing that and upholding an ethnocentric nation that discriminates against others, is now means maintaining a Jewish state, even though what that basically means is discriminating against others and often doing that through violence.
Okay, and also through discriminatory laws, which have been upheld by the Israeli Supreme Court. Some people estimate as many as 50 discriminatory laws, including a very important one, and that is the law of return, which says that any Jew anywhere in the world can go live in Israel and be a citizen, whereas Palestinians who may even have grown up in the country may have their citizens stripped very easily, their citizenship. And certainly any Palestinian who was born in the diaspora would not have the right to return, according to the Israelis. Now, you would think that if Israel is going to call itself a democracy, that it would be right in the Constitution that everybody's equal. But Israel doesn't have a constitution, does it?
No, it doesn't, and that's one reason it does not, because it would have had to clarify that. And Israel, from the beginning, and from the people who created Israel, all along knew that what they had to do often had to be kept secret from others who would disapprove if they actually knew about it. So, you know, it was consciously decided not to have a constitution because a constitution would have been problematic since they planned to discriminate against non-Jews. So, you know, even though, again, we hear our media consistently repeating that Israel is supposedly the only democracy in the Middle East, modern democracies have constitutions. You know, the only exception I can think of is Britain, which has centuries of common law, which have been, you know, are codified, and it has centuries worth of law. Whereas Israel, as a modern nation, never wrote a constitution until this day, and has never declared its borders. When people talk about Israel, we don't even know what the borders are. This was another intentional decision.
That's a very important point, and we're kind of skipping around in terms of the content of your book, but I think I'd like to go to that. And that is, what do you mean they have no borders? Didn't the partition plan specify what the borders were supposed to be?
Well, the partition plan was a recommendation that was voted by the General Assembly. The United Nations General Assembly in 1947, through bribes and threats by Zionists, voted a recommendation in which about 55% of the land of Palestine under the mandate that was being divided would be given to a Jewish state, and the Palestinians, who originally had been 95% of the population, now after massive immigration, were still about 70%, owned well over 90% of the land, were going to get only 45% of the land. But this, so there was a partition recommendation that had, certain borders between those two states that they were recommending be created. But it has no force of law. It never went to the Security Council. A number of legal scholars have written about this. So those borders are interesting, but they're not really relevant to today's world. They don't have the force of law. Where the borders are supposed to be now are actually armistice lines. When Israel was created, it was created through a war in which it got rid of large numbers of the Palestinian population. Zionist forces were very prepared for the war. They'd been arming themselves. There were gun-running operations in the United States, taking massive American weaponry illegally over to the Zionist military forces in Palestine. So they had a war, in which they then declared Israel on 78% of Palestine, and the Palestinians were down to 22%. So we have something that's called the Green Line. It's the armistice line from 1949. But that's an armistice line. It's not a border of a nation, and Israel keeps taking more property since that time period. They keep, you know, this sort of creeping annexation, both around Jerusalem itself and within the occupied territories, especially now within the West Bank. Israel continues to confiscate Palestinian land, both Christian and Muslim land, and declare it Jewish-only land for eternity. They have very strange wording in which they are, quote, reclaiming the land from the Christians and Muslims who live on it and who have lived on it, in many cases, for many centuries.
we are recording this show prior to knowing the outcome of the Netanyahu re-election campaign, but he did say that if he's re-elected, that there will never be a two-state solution, meaning they have no intention of ever complying with international law, or he has no intention of complying with international law and returning that territory to the original inhabitants prior to the formation of Israel. It's a blatant violation of international law. And as you say, Israel itself wasn't even created in accordance with international law. It was a plan, and then they changed the facts on the ground by having a war that drove out, what was it, 750,000 Palestinians violently, committing massacres in dozens of Palestinian villages, both Christian and Muslim. And what really created Israel was the recognition by the United States and later other countries of Israel, in a sense, even though it wasn't in accordance with international law. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Well, I would say, you know, first, you know, this war of ethnic cleansing that Israel calls its war of independence, that in essentially created Israel. And then because of the Israel lobby that was already so extremely powerful in the United States, Harry Truman rushed to make the U.S. the first country to recognize Israel. I think it was only a few minutes later, the second country to recognize Israel was the Soviet Union, which had also had its own purposes for doing that. I think the U.S. recognized it de facto and the Soviet Union de jure, so they both can be considered first, depending on which category you're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
That was very significant, and Truman did that over the objections of the State Department and the Pentagon, who had been telling them that this would be very damaging to Americans, that it was against the United States' national interest. Some of the many memos and reports on this were saying that this was also against American principles and against principles that had just been fought for in World War II. Yet Truman was very eager to be reelected, and the Israel lobby was very powerful, was helping to fund his reelection campaign, was giving him money on his famous whistle-stop tour on a train going around the U.S. So he did what they wanted him to do, knowing that it was the wrong thing to do. But he did it for political purposes, and that's what both parties have largely done ever since that time. There are little deviations here and there, but largely that's what they both continue to do, with, you know, a few little deviations and a few exceptions.
Now, I certainly understand the argument, but let me just ask, because this is a nonprofit educational foundation that has this show. Did he ever admit that was his motivation?
No. Well, lots of people that knew him and write about him have written that. You know, some foreign service officers even that had hoped that he had just done this for moral reasons because of concern about what had happened to Jews under Hitler, and that therefore he was very sympathetic to them and he did it for that reason. But when people really examine his actions and his statements, then consistently people, you know, many historians of different backgrounds and in different books write that it was being done for political purposes. In addition, people like his Secretary of State was George Marshall, the famous World War II general, known for the Marshall Plan that came after World War II. He told Truman when he was pushing things that were bad for the U.S. in terms of supporting the Zionist agenda to create Israel and then to support Israel, George Marshall told Truman this would be so damaging to the U.S. that he wouldn't even vote for Truman if that's what he did, if he put his domestic electoral considerations above what was best for the country. And Truman, I guess in essence, he did admit this at one point, because he said to some State Department ambassadors who were saying this type of thing to him, he said, this is a paraphrase, but he said, gentlemen, I have hundreds of thousands of constituents who are eager for Israel. I don't have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents. That's basically, I guess that was making it quite clear to them.
And again, you know, people look at this and they say, well, my gosh, Jews are such a minority. How could they have so much influence? And I think that's one reason that why we have to be very clear that we know there's incredibly strong evidence, let's just say, that this was a political decision.
Just to emphasize, I don't think I've said this yet. Zionism, okay, for many decades was not supported by most Jewish Americans. For the, you know, beginning several decades, Jewish Americans in general were not Zionists, and a number were actively anti-Zionist. There were Jewish organizations that were specifically working against the Zionist movement, trying to expose it and trying to work against it, but they were unsuccessful. They had less money and, you know, were, I think, somewhat less devious, but for whatever reason, they didn't succeed. So it was, you know, for most of the years I'm writing about it in my book, it was in no way a Jewish lobby at all. It was very much a political lobby and a small minority within the Jewish community.
That's a very important point for people to understand. Let me just repeat. You are saying that Zionism itself was considered a fringe notion for decades, and it was really a very small, relatively small number of people who supported Zionism who pushed this so much that it became so powerful that you argue in your book and present lots of evidence for this, that it was these early Zionists who pushed the U.S. into World War I in exchange for a promise from the British government that they would support a Jewish state in Palestine. Is that correct?
Well, it's correct, but I would need to modify that a little bit. That's what the Zionists said. This is what the Zionists claimed. They told the British government, Chaim Weizmann, a very prominent Zionist leader, went to the British government involved in World War I in the, quote, Great War, who, you know, were losing something like 50,000 men in the first day of the Battle of the Somme. So the British were desperate to get the U.S. in on their side of the war. British Zionist Chaim Weizmann went to the British and said, well, we can do that for you. You know, our Zionist colleagues in the United States, in particular Louis Brandeis, who was very close to Woodrow Wilson, can influence Wilson and the United States to enter the war on the side of Britain if you promise that then you will facilitate, once you win the war. It's important to remember, the war wasn't only against Germany, which is what most of us remember. It was also against the Ottoman Empire, Turkey. The Ottoman Empire held Palestine at that time. So when the British defeated the Ottoman Empire, they would then potentially have control of the Ottoman Empire and of Palestine, and that's basically what happened. So that's why what's called a gentleman's agreement was made, in which the British promised to a degree that they would help facilitate the Zionist project of colonizing Palestine to create a Jewish state in return for the Zionists in Britain and in the U.S. working together to get the U.S. to enter World War I.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, they claimed that they were the reason that the U.S. had entered the war, and a number of British leaders felt that that was the reason the U.S. had entered the war. Some American people in the American establishment and in the Foreign Service, et cetera, also knew that this was the trade-off that had been made between the Zionists and the British government, that this gentleman's agreement is how Britain was pushed to issue what's now called the Balfour Declaration. You know, whether that really was the decisive factor in why our country entered World War I, I don't know at this point. You know, I certainly feel that it was one of several factors. We've always heard of submarine warfare and the Zimmerman telegram and the Lusitania, other aspects. Most of us, in fact, no one I know of has had actually heard about the Zionist factor in the U.S. entry into World War One. This is the type of thing that historians would normally write about, research. Some people could do PhD theses on this to look into this, and maybe they would find this was the decisive factor. Maybe they would find, no, it was just one of many factors. I don't know, but certainly it's an important factor for us to know about because it gave the Zionists great leverage with Britain, who felt it had been a very important factor. So it gave Zionists a great deal of power with Britain, which at that time was, of course, the world's main world power.
Well, let me just make just summarize a couple of things you point out in the book that makes that a strong argument, that is actually one of the main things that led Wilson to break his promise and get us into war on a foreign continent. First of all, you said in the 1910s there were only 20,000 Zionists. I'm not sure quite how that number came up with, but it was still a fairly fringe idea. But by 1918, they had 10 times that many, 200,000. And you point out in the book that some of the people, like Brandeis, were very politically connected, were very successful. There were many wealthy businessmen who they reached out to specifically. They very early on reached out specifically to the media. And by the time of, by 1917, there was a study done of the media, and the four major papers that they studied were overwhelmingly presenting the Zionist point of view on all the issues pertaining to Palestine. So that's a real picture of a tremendous amount of influence in a very short time, along with an explanation, and that is that they were very clever, that they went right to the most connected people they could find, and they started to exert political pressure right off the bat. And then combine
that
with their media influence, and you have the makings of an incredibly powerful special interest group, a small one, but incredibly powerful for its size.
That's true. And they certainly, once this agreement was sort of being made between the American Zionists, the British Zionists, and the British government, they note that American news coverage began to be very pro-England, you know, very much about the need to enter the war on the side of Britain, that came at the same time. So
right.
The Zionists write about this in some articles about how, you know, they are the reason the U.S. entered the war. And certainly, you know, it's a very, very persuasive argument. They claim that, and, you know, Lloyd George said they made us a promise, and they kept it. Also, it's important to remember that special interests are often small. That's, you know, that's why we sort of call it a special interest. And special interests have driven other American policies. So, you know, even though we think, well, this is so significant, how could some very small group drive such an important policy? But special interests do that, especially if there's not a counter lobby, which there was a counter group. There were groups that were opposing this, but not really a significantly funded counter lobby the way there are on many other issues. This one was able to mobilize great amounts of money, really astoundingly large amounts of money. Plus, much of what they did, I think, was especially secretive. You know, some of it was done quite openly and publicly, but much of it was done secretively, and much of that came out afterwards. So I think that gave it additional power when you're doing something, and, you know, when you have a Supreme Court justice, two of them, in fact, Louis Brandeis and Felix Frankfurter, who are secretly working on behalf of a movement that will benefit a foreign country, that's a fairly powerful situation. And I'm not, you know, when you start looking at what actually went on, you see how they were able to achieve the results that they wanted to achieve.
Absolutely. And then this is just, we don't have a lot of time left, but this is detailed in the book. So I just want to make sure that people get that title again. It's called Against Our Better Judgment. Now, we've been focusing on pre-World War One and World War One, so obviously we're not going to get through the whole history to 1939 50, but I do think it's important that people understand we keep saying the Balfour Declaration. I'm not sure everybody knows what that was. It was a declaration by the British Foreign Minister to Lord Rothschild, who was a financier of the Zionist movement, basically saying that they supported in principle a Jewish homeland as long as it preserved the rights of everybody that's already living there. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that is. But it doesn't mention that the non-Jewish population was 90% of,
right,
of the population. It's also interesting that, you know, the Israel partisans like to make a big deal about the Balfour Declaration as though this sort of was some law that gives them the right to Palestine. It's just a letter from the foreign minister to the head of the Zionist movement at a time when Britain did not have control of Palestine and had nothing to do with the region at all, other than being at war with it. Secondly, it was actually not written, it wasn't even written by Lord Balfour. It was written by a man named Leopold Amory, who was a secret Zionist. He was sort of the final drafter of it. And the text had gone back and forth between Zionists in the U.S. and in Britain, you know, working out what the text would be, and, you know, with some British officials involved in that as well. So there's much more to that than usually people are ever told. Plus, the British at that time, it set a Jewish home in Palestine. This was the kind of terminology, Zionist, that I, as I mentioned earlier, there was this sort of secretive nature to their movement from early on. It still exists today. You know, they'd use the term home, which could, you know, in some people's mind, that meant, well, there'd be a cultural home there, you know, perhaps museums and various institutions and, you know, certainly could be a worthy undertaking. But that's not what they meant. And secretly in their letters and in their diaries and to one another, and this is on paper, so that's how we know it today, they would say, well, everybody knows what, you know, we actually mean a state. We're just saying home for now because we don't want to trigger the kind of negative response if we really said we're going to create a Jewish state there. So they would, you know, cover up what they were doing, even though inside people knew just what they were doing. And again, in my book, I have the citations. All these things that I'm saying are fully cited. I think I have something like over 350 footnotes in the book. It's over half endnotes. The endnotes sometimes contain additional information that I thought was very interesting, so I would put it in the endnote, even if I didn't think it was of sufficient importance to go in the main narrative. But all of this is thoroughly cited. You know, people can see where I'm getting the information that I'm saying today. They can get the book, look at the citations, and see exactly where I got it. And if they think it's wrong, they can look at the original sources and examine those for themselves.
I've read the book twice myself, and I just skimmed through it before this show in preparation, and I caught a number of things that I didn't catch before because it's so terse. I mean, it's so concise. It has so much information in it. And to fully grasp everything, I think you really do have to go to those references. So, all right, so you've, you know, we're getting toward the end of the show here, and we've said several times about the influence over the media. We didn't talk really about the campaigns that they used to pressure members of Congress and eventually the White House. There's a whole lot of information about that in your book. But let's just focus for a moment on the business of how they exert so much influence over the media. And by the way, you don't mention much. You mention a little about the influence in Hollywood. Again, you know, every time people try to talk about that, they say, oh, you're an anti-Semite. You're saying Jews run Hollywood and it's all for the benefit of Israel. But that's not true. The fact of the matter is, as in a recent Mondo Vice article said, this is just a plain fact that there's a disproportionate ownership of the in Hollywood studios, in newspapers, in a variety of media. That's just a fact, and it may be partly related to the fact that as a cultural group, Jews disproportionately are successful, well-educated, and so naturally they have a lot of influence. Now, this is from Mondo Vice, which is founded...
Well, it's actually, he probably got it from the Hollywood Reporter, where they, you know, a few places, in a number of Hollywood, there are a few quotes where they talk about, you know, yes, Jews run the media, so yes, we run the media, so what? You know, this is a quote, I think it was Hollywood Reporter. Another article had rule number one, talk about anything political in Hollywood except Gaza. And in this article in Hollywood Reporter, it says, it's commonplace for top executives to be on a first-name basis with prominent Israeli politicians and business leaders. Cultural affinity and political support for Israel run deep in the entertainment industry, as they have since Israel's founding in 1948. So there are, you know, this kind of factual statement is found in magazines that are published in Hollywood and in Los Angeles. It's not, you know, I'm sure people that perhaps I would consider anti-Semitic, you know, might exaggerate that and make claims that are untrue. But, you know, as far as the facts, this is often written about in Hollywood itself and pretty much acknowledged that that's the case.
Right, and you're saying that even Jewish authors do that who presumably are not anti-Semitic.
Yeah, that are not anti-Zionist, you know, not some that, you know, there are some Jewish and Israelis that Zionists and Israel partisans will say, well, that Jew is anti-Semitic.
Right, a strange accusation.
But that's right. It's not what I'm, in this case, these are just people that are not necessarily even political. They're just writing about this, honestly, factually. You know, in some cases, think what's a good thing. Look at what we've accomplished here. J.J. Goldberg wrote in his book, Jewish Power, about how much Jews have accomplished, how much power they have in the United States. In his book, he says that at least at that time, half the billionaires in the United States were Jewish. So, you know, again, there's factual information that we should look for, not claims that exaggerate something or disparage any group, but just let's look at what the facts are. But those are just, none of that is in my book, as I say. My book actually only goes to about 1950, and I don't think I even talk about the entertainment industry and about Hollywood at that time. Maybe I'm forgetting something that I put in, but I don't remember that.
No, you didn't. I just wanted to throw that in there because I also wanted to say, well, you focus mostly on the print media and talked about the different ways that they could influence the print media, such as advertising boycotts, letter writing campaigns to magazines that printed unfavorable articles, press releases to other publications to complain about the so-called anti-Semitism of any criticism of Israel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We are out of time, though, Allison. I want to thank you so much, Allison Weir, again, for being on Taking Back America, and hopefully we'll have you back on to talk about your upcoming book.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed being on your show. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet. Talk to you then. That's it this week for Taking Back America. Please join us next week.